One of these days I want to just start like singing into the mic.
Please
do,
don't.
Do you think that'd be uncomfortable? Do you think that'd be good?
I think we would lose listeners.
We're probably already losing listeners. I mean, listening to us talk for 30 episodes is that's a long time. But anyways, welcome listeners to the Aviation Renaissance. We have a good episode this week with our good friend. He's wearing a very, is that orange?
It's the Orange Dreamsicle.
The Orange Dreamsicle shirt. We need to take a picture of this so people know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But first, before we get into that, we want to give a shout out to a good customer of ours, Volt Aero. When this podcast comes out, you can go back and listen to a great episode that was posted previously. Go for it. But thank you to them and all the work we've done with them as we continue our partnership. But anyways, enough about that. Let's talk about the man of the hour. It's technical program manager.
That's right.
Ryan Boehm. Ryan, tell the people who you are.
Well, some people call, I'm on a team called the Bomb Squad. It was it kind of came about a couple different ways, but one is some people in the company, I won't name names, have, I don't think ever called me Ryan Boehm. It's always been Ryan Boehm, and so kind of generated the idea to form a team name, the Bomb Squad. So
I like it.
I figured you would like
I
that.
Do, I do like it.
As officially having been on a Bomb Squad,
correct.
I think that makes sense, but yeah.
The bomb. Yeah, if he would have said no, he didn't like bombs, I'd be concerned about him. But
so the technical lead for the Bomb Squad, that's right. What you currently do. Where'd you grow up?
I am a Cache Valley boy right here in Logan, Utah. I was born in Salt Lake, but when I was about 2 years old, moved up to Mendon, Utah.
Oh, yeah.
Small Indian. Little town, beautiful Cache Valley, and I love this place. Hope to live and die here.
So what is your education background in?
So I have a bachelor's degree in computer engineering, and I kind of always knew that I wanted to be an engineer ever since I was just a little kid. I originally wanted to be an astronaut, but
who didn't?
Yeah, I know. It sort of morphed into, I always knew I loved designing and building things, and so went into engineering.
Did you go to USU here?
Utah State, yeah. And then I did a MBA also at Utah State.
All of these multiple degree individuals.
Well, he's a computer engineer.
Right.
And now he deals with big mechanical stuff and electric stuff. And
yeah, I'd say my background, really, I consider electric vehicles sort of the start of my career. But I guess if you go back even farther, the first project that I did that I was 13 and I always wanted to build a go-kart. Loved go-karts.
Who doesn't? I love go-karts.
So I'm mowing the lawn. I'm conjuring images in my head of how to build a go-kart. Back then, you couldn't go on the internet and watch YouTube about how to build a go-kart. So I found a book at the library about go-karts and then dreamed up how I was going to build it. Went to a local company here, talked to them, barely probably over the counter, talking to them about what metal I'm going to buy, and cutting it with the hacksaw, and got a couple of neighbors that helped weld it together. And I actually still have the go-kart, drive it around every once in a while when my brother comes and visits. We go out, and last time we rode it, it was raining and muddy, and we were just mud-covered, and it was a blast. But so that was kind of my first foray into engineering and designing, and it's been a lot of fun.
Do you ever remember the ads in the back of the magazine for Boy Scouts?
Oh.
You remember those? Mm. Where they had the ad for the hovercraft made with a vacuum motor?
Oh, I do. Yeah.
I wanted to do one of those so bad, but my mom wouldn't let me.
Oh, come on.
I know. Anyway.
So I mentioned electric vehicles. The start of my design and build was with that, but then in my sophomore year, computer engineering degree, I had a buddy, this was in 2003, and he was telling me about electric cars. And back then you couldn't buy an electric car. And so the only way to get one was to build one. And I was thinking, you know, this is crazy. Why are you interested in electric cars? They can only go, you know, back then it was like you put lead acid batteries, you filled them up all the way to the brim, basically all the way to the gross vehicle weight rating with batteries, and you could go maybe 40 or 50 miles. And I'm thinking, man, who wants a car that you can only go 40 or 50 miles? And one day my car, it was a 1984 Nissan 200SX.
So
this isn't a Z car. It's, you know, not that cool of a car, but it was turbocharged and, you know, decent car, but it had 200,000 miles, and I poor college student, just married a couple of years, had a kid, and I want to keep this car going. And I'm thinking, one day it just hits me like a ton of bricks. I only drive 5 miles a day. What am I worried about if it can go 30 or 40 miles? So I had to convert it. I had to make it electric.
No way.
And you did.
I gutted the whole thing.
Oh my gosh.
Got all the parts and ended up making an electric car that could go about 10 miles on a charge, 10 or 12. I had a buddy that borrowed it once, and he came back and he said, yeah, I drove it 18 miles. I'm like, I did not know you could do that.
Was that 5 miles one way that you had to drive, or was that
about 2 or 3 miles? Oh. I didn't live far from campus. And so it was just a very minimal drive, but yeah, I did have, I think one time that I got stranded, I was only a mile away from home, and you could just tell that the power just starts dropping, and it wouldn't automatically shut off. It would just go till the batteries were dead. So I pull off to the side of the road, and I went and knocked on somebody's door that was right there, almost by the Mount Logan Middle School, and walked up, and I didn't, back then, again, no one's driving electric cars, and sure. So what are they going to think? So I just said, yeah, my car's got a problem. I need to plug in a cord to fix it. And they're, oh, sure, go ahead. So plugged in, charged for about 30 minutes, and away I went the last mile. So
how long would that take to get a full charge on it?
Oh, it was just a 3 or 4 hours or so.
Oh, that's not too bad.
Yeah. For like 15 miles, 3 to 4 hours? Yeah.
Something along those lines.
What was what was the energy rating on this?
Wow, you're digging back.
I'm in my BD mode right now. I need to know voltages, kilowatt hours.
Wow, so it had 13 deep cycle batteries. They were, I'd have to work out the math again. They were about 40 amp hour, about 156 volt nominal. So you could work that out, do the numbers in my head. But
yeah, sounds pretty good to me, though.
Yeah.
For 2003, you said? This is almost 20 years ago. I mean, the first Roadster from Tesla didn't come out till 2009.
Yeah.
Right? And that was like a 150K vehicle. So,
this was right at the same time that Musk and his guys were investigating electric cars. I mean, they were looking into the feasability of electric cars. Of course, they were looking at doing it with laptop batteries, which, if only I'd had that epiphany, then,
That sounds like
that was Randy Dunn. Randy Dunn was doing the same thing, yeah.
Well, that, and I'm pretty sure they had much more financial backing behind them in order to do that.
Sophomore in college,
Right.
Right.
How much did that cost for that retrofit, you think? Like, what do you think you put into that?
You know, that's probably the funniest thing that I think my wife's still probably upset about that project. Because I thought, I found a motor on eBay, and that was one day I get this idea, and I did a lot of things on eBay, and I'm looking for electric vehicle motor, and I find one on there for, I think it was $700. And so I was like, oh man, it can't be much more, a few batteries, who knows what other stuff, but a couple thousand, I could either rebuild my engine in this old car, because I love this car, I'd had it since I was 16, or I could convert it to electric for a couple thousand, but I think it was closer to 10,000 by the time I was done with
it. No way.
Wow.
So, but she better not listen to this episode.
Well,
she
we're going to go send this to your wife and your kids.
Not the true cost of that car.
your oldest is going to be like, wait, wait, wait. You spent how much when I was a kid?
Yeah, that's right.
Oops.
How many kids do you have?
So I have 3. My son is 19, and then 2, 17, and a 12-year-old.
Okay. So, I've got a 21 and a 12-year-old.
All right, in the same ballpark.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't know if I want to get off this electric car subject, because how many man hours did this take?
Oh my gosh, that's the other thing that I'm sure she's still bitter over.
Put a riff in your marriage?
it still has. But
20 years later,
I started it officially in April. That's when I started ripping all the stuff out, and then I had it for the first drive was in December of that same year, 2003.
So 8 months.
Yeah. Lot of nights, did that in the middle of the
winter too. Did you have a garage, or was this outside?
No, this was under a carport. Yeah.
Oh wow,
that was miserable.
Yeah, because winters here in Cache Valley can get pretty cold.
But you do what you got to do. You got to be a little bit innovative and resourceful. So you do what you got to do.
That's right. So, how long have you been at EPS?
About a year. It'll be a year in October.
And where were you prior?
I had I had a small stint at a small company working on energy storage systems for refrigerated transport. And prior to that, I was working with Utah State University, which is how I got to know the people at EP Systems, the work that they close work that they did with the university, and got to know Nate and Mike and Derek and Kevin all in the kind of early days. And that's, you know, saw these resourceful guys again, you know, and doing something really amazing. And it was fun watching them kind of from the outside. Never really thought that I'd be a part of the team. But I was working with the university on electrified roadways, wireless charging of in-motion vehicles, which is a fascinating technology, something that was really cool to be a part of. I got started in that in about 2012. I was running my own company. So after I did this car conversion stuff, I saw, you know, there was kind of a dearth of places that you could go buy the components and the support to do these conversions. And you know, again, you couldn't buy an electric car then, so you could build one. And there was a growing interest in converting your car. So I started a company selling the conversion components and ended up selling that 10 years later in 2014. And the company's still in operation, which is kind of fun to see. But in the process of running this company, I'd heard that I'd worked at the Space Dynamics Lab as a student, and I bumped into one of my professors there, and he mentioned that a couple years after I wasn't working there anymore, and he said, "Hey, you should get involved." I told him what I was doing he knew that I had been working with electric cars, and while I was working there at the Space Dynamics Lab, and he said, "Hey, apparently Space Dynamics Lab is getting involved in electric vehicle research, and you ought to get in touch with them." So I thought, "Hey, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. Maybe they need some of my services or some of the components that I sell." And so I got in touch, and then kind of ended up finding out that they needed. And it was kind of weird. The guy that I was telling all this about, he started talking about a position that they needed to fill there with an electrical engineer. And I thought, man, he's describing me to a T, like that. That's me. And you know, I was fully engaged in my own business and wasn't looking for other employment. But it just, as I went on their website and looked at what they're doing with the wireless roadway concept, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. This is the way forward for sustainable electrified transportation. Like this is the only way I see that everyone in the country could drive an electric car. You know, if everyone's going to have a 300 or 400 mile range electric car, just think how many batteries that is. That is a lot of batteries. Well, if you can scale that down to maybe a 75 mile range where all you have to do is get to the interstate and then you can go anywhere in the country without ever even getting off of the highway, then that is a pretty cool concept, and it's very compelling. And they're doing still doing some very, very great research and even pilot projects in that. So it was a fascinating period of my life working with that initially static wireless charging demonstrations that we did there, and then that evolved into in motion demonstrations. And but then you know, things saw some entrepreneurial opportunities with another company, went there for a little while, and then got in touch was keeping in touch with the people that I knew at EP Systems, and found that there were opportunities at EP Systems, and it just became again compelling to be a part of what this electric transportation renaissance, which is just so exciting to be a part of.
It's so why the change from electric vehicles to electric aviation?
You know, electric vehicles are awesome. Electric vehicles are amazing, but they're kind of solved in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. You know, the wireless charging is not it's not solved in the sense of it being deployed, but even from a technological standpoint, a lot of that has now been proven and it's in the process of being sold to, you know, various places where it could be implemented in terms of, you know, governments or commercial or industrial. It's kind of solved. I see it as it's matured to a point where I want to now move beyond something that's just at the bleeding edge of technology, and electric aircraft is that. Like it's not solved yet. It's in the very early stages, and to me it's so fun to be at the forefront, the pioneering stage of technology. So it's in that way so compelling to be a part of.
How much of a crossover is there between electric vehicles and electric aviation?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think there's a lot of leveraging that can be taken that will be taken with the technologies that exist for electric vehicles, both in terms of infrastructure. One of the topics that we have here is on infrastructure, and we are leveraging automotive standards for aviation charging. And I think that will continue for some time. It will very well evolve into standards that are more geared towards some of the nuances of aviation. But we are the beneficiaries of the technology that's been developed for the automotive sector.
Awesome. So you work up at Hyde Park, where the SIL lab, Systems Integration Lab.
That's correct.
And also that's where we are putting Mobile Mic together.
Yep.
Tell us what you're doing up there.
So the bomb squad is...
The bomb squad.
We are leading out the efforts on, as you mentioned, the SIL and Mobile Mic. And Mobile Mic is a platform, a mobile platform for mobile microgrid. Imagine you've talked about that on other segments at some point.
We have a little bit.
Why it's Mobile Mic shortened for mobile microgrid.
Just some dude named Mike, just his truck.
We do have a lot of mics at the
we
company.
We do, actually. So
there are five mics.
Oh, my goodness. Systems.
I'm sure they all feel it was named after them.
Yes, but, of course they do.
Each one, it's like their little brainchild of that effort. But mobile microgrid, and maybe in some ways microgrid isn't fully representative of its current state. There's no generation and energy generation on board, but it could take advantage of solar input or other energy generation. But it's basically a battery on wheels with charging capability, and because of the rate that we're charging the aircraft at, how fast we're charging, we've got to be able to remove that heat. So we've also got to pump fluid through those aircraft, and so it has onboard refrigeration equipment, and then also is able to manage reeling those cables out to the aircraft to plug in the charging cord, and as well as and for those that might be interested, it's we leveraging CCS one interface for charging, and then we have the liquid cooling connections that plug into the aircraft as well, and so it provides that refrigeration and it takes the battery to through a conversion stage to be able to charge the aircraft.
Yeah, we had it out at Oshkosh, and there was nothing but stellar reception of having that capability. You know, because that was one thing that was always asked is not so much the two biggest questions were asked was how long can I fly it and how long does it take to recharge it. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's kind of like the Tesla supercharging stations, right? Is kind of how I explained it to them. It's a fast charge rate, 20 minutes for a recharge on it. And it was baffling to a lot of people that were able to do that. But like you said, we have to cool it down and whatnot in order to make it work. It was very well received out at Oshkosh.
Yeah, I think it. When you think of what the current paradigm for flying is, you've got a fuel truck and it drives out to the aircraft, reels something out, put it in the plane, dispense that fuel, and then drives away. And this fits that same paradigm. Fast, 20 minutes in the world of recharging is very fast. In the world of refueling is would be considered slow, but it's an amazing step for us to take to get to that level of refueling.
So we talk about liquid cooling. Let's talk about that a little bit more. So your Tesla fast chargers are not liquid cooled, correct? So he's nodding his head.
Yeah, that's right.
But would liquid cooling be an option for stationary chargers for airports and infrastructure, or is it just mobile microgrid that's going to be able to do that?
Yeah, we anticipate and as we are looking at the fixed infrastructure, mm-hmm. So we've talked about the mobile aspect, but there will be many applications where a fixed charger is the appropriate solution. Pull the plane up just like you would a vehicle to a charge station and pull the cord out, plug it in, and that will also be applicable in that case. I have to have the thermal management system that cycles the fluid through the aircraft. And I think, I don't know that we've seen vehicles, or at least the prevalence of vehicles that can charge in 20 minutes. And so that could become a constraint there. But one of the, there might be other ways to deal with that on board a vehicle that aren't as appropriate for an aircraft where weight is so critical. Every decision that we make with the equipment that we put on the aircraft, the weight comes up. Weight is a critical part of that. And so refrigeration systems and cooling and cooling methods on the aircraft are harder to implement because of that weight factor. And, you know, it's even worth mentioning that when it comes to weight, the fluid that we pump through the aircraft, we purge that out after the charge because it's not needed anymore during flight. So even that amount of weight is we take into consideration.
It's not a whole lot of weight within those cooling plates in there, too. I mean, a whole lot of fluid within there, but it is, like you said, critical to get weight down because you're not just driving a vehicle down the road. You are trying to lift heavy things into the air and keep them up in the air.
Yep.
I was having a conversation with a coworker and they had said, well, why don't you just use this kind of rivet instead of this kind of rivet? And it's like, this is aircraft, right? You got to look at every single component that goes in there and try to reduce weight as much as possible but maintaining safety and integrity.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been something that's been exciting for me, not having an aviation background to be learning all of those pieces of how things are done different from the automotive world to the aviation world. And it's exciting to get to learn new things. And this is a great place to be learning it.
Yeah, I went and worked with Bryant and got certified to work in the SIL as a safety up there. And I don't think a lot of people realize the kind of testing that has to go through it. So our systems integration lab, why don't you explain to our listeners what that is?
Yeah, so as we develop these systems and the systems that we have for the batteries and all of the supporting electronics, and we've got to have a way to test those. Now, you could, of course, put those on the aircraft and do some high-speed taxi runs and spin up the motor, and then when you find that you need to modify something or you need to run a test on something that adds a certain nuance to that, then on an aircraft, that's rather difficult to do. And so what we've designed is a very capable piece of stationary equipment that's basically on the back of a flatbed truck that has a motor truss, the electric motor, an electric motor, and various electric motors could be adapted to fit onto. And then we have the battery racks on there and blowers and test equipment, data acquisition, and we can pull that outside of the facility. We can take it to the airport. We could drive it to the top of a mountain. We can take it various places for different environments and run up the motor with a propeller on it. And it's really pretty fun to see it, especially driving down the road, because you've got this. I would love to hear what people are thinking as they watch this truck go by with a propeller on the back of it. They've got to be thinking someone is really nuts.
Right. Just like somebody made a Nissan 200SX into an electric car, right?
Yeah.
How long did that run for, by the way?
So I drove that for probably 5 or 6 years. And
oh,
then
my goodness.
The only reason I stopped driving it was I had my eyes set on a newer vehicle and more power and different capabilities, and I finally had to retire that poor car.
I am going to call you out on this, right? Why aren't you driving an electric vehicle now?
Oh, my gosh.
You drive a BMW. Oh. I mean, it's a 5 Series,
that's,
right?
No, it's 3 Series.
It's a 3 Series. I mean, it's a nice car. It's a beautiful car, but...
Okay, so the predecessor, the vehicle to this was... I had an 02 3 Series BMW, and it actually had... bought that with the express purpose of converting that to electric.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
But, and I bought, it had a blown engine in it, supposedly. And I get it, and I was going to rip out the engine. And I even took it to have the AC, the refrigerant removed. And I'm getting ready to pull the engine. But I had to know what was wrong with the engine so I could sell it. And, I was going to sell off the engine. And come to find out, it had very minor problems to it. Some leaky gaskets and, dripping oil down on the exhaust and causing smoke to come out when you start it. And it turned out with very little effort, I had this engine running beautifully. And so I was like, I just can't get myself to tear out this perfectly working engine. And so, but I was like, it's got to be electric. And so I designed a hybrid where I had a 10 kilowatt hour battery pack in the trunk. It was a feat to get the thing in and out. It was very difficult to get this, but it was designed to come in and out. Wow. The electric motor sat underneath it and tied to a custom design that I had custom developed for the rear differential. And it tied into the rear. So you have the driveline coming in the front of the differential and then the electric motor into the back of it. And so I demonstrated that hybrid. It tied into the throttle, intercepted the throttle signals and fed back in and was able to demonstrate that concept. And, I have fun with the project and then I move on to another one. And sure. I don't have that vehicle anymore. And so now I have this one and I don't currently have any plans to electrify my BMW now. It's moving on to, I have other projects in the pipeline that I won't tell you about here, but someday I might.
Now you got my curiosity piqued. I'm trying to convince my wife to let me buy a kit plane to build a plane. And
then convert that to electric.
Eventually. Ooh. That's the ongoing discussion in my household for my next project. I'm the same way. I like to get a new project, build it, finish it, be done with it, and then start on to the next.
Okay, well, you got to do the kit plane. That fits perfectly. But it's got to be electric. So
I need to build it with gas first, right? Because I need to understand how it goes together.
There's some truth to that.
And so I will build it first, and then I will eventually maybe convert it to electric. Or I'll just buy a DA40.
I was going to say, we'll give you the batteries to retrofit it. I mean,
I don't think you'd give them to me.
No, you'd buy them. Buy them. Maybe at a good price if you're nice. So my last question here, I really want to hear from Ryan. And I don't know where we're at on time, but
We got time.
So cycle life, that's kind of the big one. So you mentioned having your car for 5-6 years, and you put probably a lot of cycles on those batteries. But, you know, in terms of cycle life for the future and charging, the big question that people ask is, if you fast charge, will that diminish cycle life? How does infrastructure as a whole, like, reduce or increase cycle life? What feedback do you have on that?
Yeah, it does have an effect, and there's extremes that on the batteries that, you know, batteries when they're operated within a very shallow cycles and very limited temperature range, very controlled temperature ranges, can live very, very long lives. Mm-hmm. As you push them to those extremes of temperature, both low temperature operation and high temperature, and holding them at high temperatures and keeping them at pushing them to high states of charge is really a degradation mechanism for lithium cells. So going to those extremes does have an effect, and it has to be balanced in the, you know, grand scheme of things. I think one thing that might be interesting to is our view of second life opportunities. That you imagine you've had opportunities to talk about that before, but we don't see these batteries that go on the aircraft and get down to a certain percentage of capacity, you know, maybe 80-85% state of health, that we don't just get rid of them and recycle them. They have additional uses, and mobile mic is one of those opportunities for us to take those batteries and put them into another, give them another life, a long good life, and so you know that can then of course be balanced with those extremes that are taken on the batteries for fast recharge. Give them a hard first life and an easy second life.
Mm-hmm. Man, I've had a hard first life. When does the easy second life come into play?
That is always the question.
That is always the question. So the infrastructure that are going to go to airports and whatnot, excluding mobile microgrid, what is the plan for that as far as grid storage goes out there?
Well, grid storage will likely be an important part of that for various reasons. Some of those could include the ability to reduce your peak demand on the grid.
Right.
Of course, the grid connection has to be managed. A lot of questions come up about, you know, with both electric transportation in general. I think mostly in the context of the automotive world, because that's what people think of when they think of electric vehicles. Most of them haven't gotten there to thinking of electric aviation, but is can the grid handle it? And you know, there's various studies out there to show what it can handle and how it will handle that. But I think there's a pretty good consensus that it can handle a lot more than what we think it can, especially if we manage the time of day use, that during the evening times and off peak, there's a lot of capacity on generation that just goes idle, and it's not very efficient when it's idle. And so if we can use that at the different times of day, but that then does necessitate a way to store that energy during those off-peak times and be able to deliver it during the peak demand times. So I think energy storage will become an important part of managing that infrastructure to deal with the grid.
Yeah, our next guest, David Koch. He's our first repeat guest.
Yeah,
is David.
Yeah.
We'll get into more with that with him because he is our infrastructure guy. But Ryan, it's been great to have you on.
Been fun to be here.
And it's been very informative. I had no idea that you were such a mad scientist. It's exciting. Maybe we could collaborate on one of your secret projects you have going on right now.
Okay.
Okay. I'll sign an NDA, I promise.
That's good.
But that's this week's show of the Aviation Renaissance. Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you want to learn more about EPS, you can go to epsenergy.com. If you're looking for employment, we're always hiring. In a fast-paced, exciting aviation industry, like Ryan said, we are on the leading edge, the cutting edge of new technology. If you like what you've heard, leave us a 5-star review. You can find us and listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Amazon, Google Podcast. Just go in, search us. If you like what you hear, leave us a comment. If there's something you want to hear about, leave us a comment. And like and share. Thanks.